We've been reading through the Gospel of Mark during the season of Lent. We've encouraged all of our members to do that. I don't know whether you've actually done that or not. If I asked you to shake your head, you'd probably say yes, but probably some of you have been cheating, but that's okay. We're at chapter 16 today. It's the last chapter in Mark, and I'll tell you, as I read it this year, now Mark, all the Gospel writers tell the story at the end pretty much the same. There are variations, but I'm always surprised that it's not as joyful as you would think it to be. And the reason is simple, and you'll see it in the text. The disciples were confused. They were skeptical. They did not believe. You'll see it at least twice, I think, in this text. And they were afraid. You'll see that over and over again. All the gospel writers. So I think it always, if you came here and you've got your doubts about the resurrection, you've got really good company in the lives of the disciples. We're going to tell you how those lives were changed. Let's read chapter 16. These are the final words in Mark, except for just a couple of sentences closing. When the Sabbath was over, Mary Magdalene and Mary the mother of James and Salome bought spices so that they might go and anoint him. And very early on the first day of the week, when the sun had risen, they went to the tomb. They'd been saying to one another, "Who will roll away the stone for us from the entrance of the tomb?" When they looked up, they saw that the stone, which was very large, had already been rolled back. As they entered the tomb, they saw a young man dressed in a white robe sitting on the right side, and they were alarmed. But he said to them, "Do not be alarmed. You are looking for Jesus of Nazareth, who was crucified. He has been raised. He is not here. Look, there's the place they laid him. But go tell all of his disciples and Peter." He singles out Peter because Peter had been so cowardly earlier in the week. "Go tell his disciples and Peter that he is going ahead of you to Galilee. There you will see him just as he told you." So they went out and fled from the tomb, for terror and amazement had seized them. They were afraid. And they said nothing to anyone, for they were afraid. Now, after he rose early on the first day of the week, he appeared first to Mary Magdalene, from whom he had cast out seven demons. And she went out and told those who had been with him while they were mourning and weeping. But when they heard that he was alive and had been seen by her, watch this phrase, they would not believe it. After this, he appeared in another form to two of them as they were walking into the country. And they went back and told the rest, but they did not believe them. You see it over and over again. The disciples were doubters. Later, he appeared to the 11 themselves as they were sitting at the table, and he upbraided them for their lack of faith and stubbornness because they had not believed those who saw him after he had risen. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. I grew up, for the most part, in Dallas, Texas. I lived in Dallas during the 50s and early 60s. But when I was in the ninth grade, we moved to Denison, Texas. Most of you know where Denison is, a town about 25,000, about 50 miles north of here, just south of the Red River on Lake Texoma. Living in Denison in the 60s, it was a great place to live. At least for me, it was. I loved it. It was a great time to be alive. Back in those days, Methodists and Baptists, most of my friends at high school were either Methodist, they went to my church, or they were a Baptist. And some of you who grew up in Texas back in those days, you'll get this. In those days, we still had old-fashioned revivals. And oftentimes the revivals would be at the same time. The Baptists would be having their revival at the same time that the Methodists had their revival. And I can remember going to a high school on Monday mornings after we'd had a revival. And all my Baptist friends would come up to me and they'd say, "Hey, we had our revival this weekend. How about you? Did you all have a revival? And how did it go?" I said, "Yeah, we had a great revival. I had a really good guest preacher. It was terrific." They said, "Well, we had a wonderful revival too. We saved 31 people. How many people did you save?" And I would say, "Well, we didn't actually save anyone, but it's not a contest, is it?" And they would say, "Yes, it is. We won 31 to nothing." Those of you who grew up in the South, you get that, right? Well, it's interesting to me. I got to thinking about that because when we look at the disciples in this moment, which should have been the moment of their greatest triumph, You think about this for just a moment. They have lived through this 3 years of ministry with Jesus. He's coming to Jerusalem. They thought he was going to set up an earthly kingdom. Instead, they see him on a cross. They hear him saying the words, "It is finished." And suddenly what he had predicted is true. He is risen. This moment, which should have been their moment of greatest triumph and joy, they look like anything but winners. They look like losers. Mark, Matthew, John, and Luke all use these words. They were confused, they were afraid, and they were skeptical. They did not believe. It really is a remarkable picture for us as the church to look back and look at what we think is the most joyful day in the lives of the disciples and discovered that it was a pretty mixed picture. But this is even more interesting. If we move from that day of the resurrection to the days of the early church, we see just the opposite. We see the church on fire. And we wonder how it happened. How did the disciples move from doubt and fear and confusion to becoming such remarkable leaders that they literally set the church on fire? When you turn to Acts, which is the first book after the Gospels, it's the story of the church. We're told that the disciples added members to the church day by day. On a daily basis, people were joining the church. But more importantly, I think, and more compelling, is the historical record. It's not what the Bible tells us, it's what the historians tell us. And this is what historians tell us, without any kind of prejudice about faith. Historians tell us that the church grew like wildfire. Frankly, the church grew so fast in the early years that by the time we get to the 4th century AD, the church has defeated the Roman Empire. Now, I want you to get this little bit of an historical nugget. We talked about it a little bit last year. Constantine, who was the emperor of Rome, one night in his old age had a dream, and he awakened the next day. He said, "I had a dream. God came to me. I'm converting to be a Christian." Most historians doubt that story. They say they just think that was a convenient story, and the reason Constantine said that is because the Roman Empire had already, in fact, fallen to Christ. That over one half of Roman citizens had converted to Christianity by the 4th century AD. Now, how do you explain that? Some of you have been to Rome, you've seen the Colosseum, you've seen the catacombs. You think about the early persecution of the Christians who hid in the catacombs, the murders, the torturing, the crucifixions, the Colosseum, the lions. The Romans did everything they could do to torture, murder, and kill and intimidate Christians. And yet the church grew like wildfire. And soon the Roman Empire fell to the love of Christ. That's what the historical record says. It was the love of the Christians that made the difference. It was the fact that they cared for people who were hungry. They shared their food with one another. They took care of those who were ill, those who had been injured. They adopted children who had been abandoned that nobody else wanted. They refused to give up on one another because they believed in a God that was so vital, a God that could not be stopped. If you want proof of the resurrection, I think you find no better proof than looking at the early church and saying that somehow God could not be stopped. And the church caught on fire because the early disciples, the early followers of Christ, knew that Christ lived, was alive in the world. So just two facts about the disciples. The first is this: they were the most passionate human beings who ever lived. I love this fact about them. They never doubted. We see them in this upper room. Yeah, they had full of doubts in this upper room. We don't know who we are, where we've come from, where we're going. But at some point, they realized that God was alive, and they never doubted what their purpose was in life. Their lives were full of meaning and purpose. St. Peter is the best example. I pointed out earlier in Mark, Jesus says, "Go tell the disciples," and Peter, he knew Peter would need an extra word of encouragement, because we know that night when Jesus was arrested around the campfire. The woman said, she called Peter in the light. She said, "Oh, you're one of them, aren't you? You're one of the disciples. You're one of those with Jesus, aren't you?" And Peter, who thought of himself as being a great leader, a remarkably courageous, Peter said, "Oh, I don't know what you're talking about." Three times she confronted him. "Yeah, you're a follower of Jesus." Three times he denied Jesus. So how do you explain this? Peter went from being a coward to being one of the most heroic people who ever lived in all of history. Not only was he a leader of the church, but we are told, this is just a rumor in the early church, but I think most scholars believe it's probably true. We don't have factual proof of it. That when the authorities finally caught up with Peter and took Peter to his death, he said to them, "I do not deserve to die like my Lord. Crucify me upside down. Crucify me upside down." How do you explain the transformation of Peter from coward to fearless? I'll just have to tell you that for me, what's so compelling about this story is I look at the early disciples who lived with such meaning and purpose and power and passion, and I want to be like that. I think you want to live like that, don't you? You know, there's a story that I've told through the years about a congressman by the name of Wilbur Mills. Some of you are old enough to remember Wilbur Mills. He was a congressman from Arkansas. The 60s and early 70s. He was chairman of the Powerful Ways and Means Committee. He was a brilliant legislator. He was a compelling personality, one of the most powerful men in Washington, D.C. There were rumors that one day he would run for and be elected to the presidency of the United States. Early one Sunday morning in 1974, tragedy struck Wilbur Mills, personal tragedy. He was discovered by the Washington, D.C. police inside an automobile on the side of the Potomac, in a ditch on the side of the Potomac, drunk, and with an exotic Brazilian exotic dancer by the name of Fanny Fox. How many of you remember the name Fanny Fox? Some of you do. Yes. And the story unfolded. Wilbur Mills had started having bouts of drinking, alcoholism, and he had developed this relationship. He'd had an affair with this Brazilian exotic dancer by the name of Fanny Fox. And of course, his career was over. That's just one of many kind of these little minor episodes that we read in the politics of America, and it wouldn't be memorable at all to me, except I've remembered it all these years, not because of the incident, but because of an editorial I read a few days afterward. It was in the Dallas Morning News. It was written by a columnist who knew Wilbur Mills pretty well, and he was a fan. He admired him. And it was a very sympathetic column. He said, when Wilbur Mills came to Washington, he was full of dreams and ideas. He wanted to change things for the better. He was a passionate and brilliant leader. But over the years, he lost his passion and his sense of purpose and his meaning in life. And then this is what he said. This is the phrase I'll never forget. He said, Congressman Mills had become like a lawnmower, just going back and forth from his office to the Capitol, from his office to his Capitol, back and forth, until he no longer remembered why he came to Washington. And I remember when I read that, I was in my 20s. I thought, here was a man whose life had become spiritually impoverished. And I thought, I hope that never happens to me. That would be the worst thing that could ever happen to someone, is to become so spiritually impoverished that you just become like a lawnmower, going back and forth like a lawnmower. I feared that all of my life. Not that I feared becoming an alcoholic or worried about having an affair with an exotic dancer. I might have thought about that a time or two. But feared that I would lose my passion and just become like a lawnmower going back and forth, losing your sense of purpose and meaning in life. What we see with the disciples is just the opposite. Lives full of purpose and meaning and passion. They literally ran through the pages of history. They defeated the Roman Empire. They changed the world forever. Today, Rome doesn't exist at all, but the church does, and the good news of his resurrection. Somehow, I think the disciples encountered the risen Christ in such a way that, to use the phrase for today, they just came to understand that somehow, even in the midst of death and tragedy, that God always wins. God always wins. They somehow came to understand that when it looks like everything is finished, God is just beginning. They would go to the grave of a loved one and say, "Nope, this is not an ending, this is just beginning." We have these prayer cards there in the pews in front of you. Every Sunday, people fill out prayer cards, dozens and dozens, every single Sunday. In the 36 years that I've been your pastor, every Sunday, prayer cards have been turned in. And I want to tell you what we do with these. One of the members of our staff, Marilyn Smith, takes the names and the prayers off the prayer cards and puts them on a sheet of paper. And then when we start our staff meeting every Wednesday, she reads out the prayer request. And there's dozens of them every week. In the years that I've been here, I have heard literally thousands and thousands and thousands of prayer requests. And honestly, you can't sit in there. If you really listen, I mean, this happens to all of us. You're thinking about other things, you go to sleep, and then all of a sudden you start listening to the prayer request and the names of those who are sick and dying or those who are hurting. You can't listen to it without it touching your heart. But all of these thousands of prayer requests through the years, there's one that I will never forget. It was a simple request. It just said, "I pray for a broken heart." A broken heart. And I thought, in some ways, that sums up every prayer request we've ever received, all of those thousands through the years, doesn't it? In one way or another, it's someone asking for a prayer because of a broken heart. I think it was T.S. Eliot who said that all of our grief comes from something that ends before we were ready for it to end. That's such a powerful phrase, I think. I've thought about it through the years. The teenager whose grandparent dies before they're ready. The person whose marriage ends too soon. The person whose parent or child dies and leaves them with a broken heart. And we know this. Sooner or later, life is going to break your heart. And it happened to the disciples. It happened to the disciples on that day when they saw Jesus on the cross. They had entered Jerusalem with such high hopes. And then they saw Jesus on the cross uttering the words, "It is finished." I don't know how it happened, but I know it happened. At some point, they realized it was not finished. That Jesus was risen and alive, that God is alive and powerful in the world. For the last few years, I have quoted Louis L'Amour at Easter. I just think this has become my favorite phrase. I think it describes what Easter is. The great Western writer occasionally could turn a great phrase. And he once said this: "There will come a moment when you will believe that everything is finished. That will be the beginning." That's exactly what happened with the disciples. Huddled up in that little room where probably they had received the Last Supper with Jesus a few days earlier. Even when they heard the news that he was risen, they couldn't believe it. They believed that everything was finished. But in the ensuing days and weeks and years, they experienced the power of a risen Christ. And they knew that God could not be stopped. God could not be stopped on the cross. God could not be stopped by the stone at the tomb. God cannot be stopped at the grave. Somehow, they came to believe that God always wins. God has all eternity, and God always wins. May it be so in your life and mine. In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen.